And the way they respond in terms of their anger is they grab these torches, these resin torches from bystanders, and they run out into the dance floor, and they will put the torch to the back of the dancer who has made them weep, and then they'll sort of drop the torch and run off to the veranda, and they might just sit out there and weep for the evening. Now, from our point of view, I think this sounds very bizarre. It sounds very dramatic. But from the Kalali point of view, the burning is really not all that important. What's important is whether the songs made people cry. Now, the dancers are in fact all volunteers. There's no set of particular things associated with having your back burned. People aren't afraid of that. The dancers are in a mild trance anyway from their dance. The burn is on the shoulder in a place where the skin is very thick, and the torch burns at a very low heat, and it's a resin torch, so it seals. So these things never really get infected. So just from a medical point of view, it's not really a very spectacular burn. But all men in the society have these marks, these scars on their shoulders. And what it means is they've composed the song and performed the song, which has moved somebody else to tears. Now, moving somebody to tears is really the sort of core symbol. And the fact that it's responded to with this anger sort of leads into the scenario of the aftermath of the ceremony, which is the person who composed the song, the person who made this person cry, gives food to that person as a way of repaying them for having made them so grieving, having made them so sorrowful, and having made them burn them. And so relationships are re-solidified and re-established. It's very, very hard to explain this sort of extremely spectacular kind of event quickly, and I think it's one of the things that people ask the most about, because from our point of view, this seems so barbaric, or, you know, we use words like that. But from the Kalali point of view, the thing which has to be emphasized is that a song is really not a song unless it can move someone to tears, that the power of evocation is the primary craft of the composer. So if I wanted to compose a song that's going to move you to tears, I have to learn a lot about your history. I have to learn a lot about who you are. I have to learn how to craft that song in a certain way. And there's a certain joy in that. And at the same time at these ceremonies, there are a lot of other things which are going on. Men who perform particularly beautifully might find that women want to elope with them. There are all sorts of social consequences of the performance of this. It's not really just a musical situation like where there's a stage and an audience. In fact, there's no real stage-audience dividing line.
During the first song that we heard, and we heard men singing, inspiring some of the men into weeping, and there was a steady rhythm, I think it was a rattle, mm-hmm. going on behind that. And it was a pretty rapidly paced beat.
Right.
And you said that a lot of the people who were listening to that were really entering a trance state.
Yeah, the rattle is at a metric pace of about 120 to 125 pulses per minute. And what it does is it gets louder and louder, and it changes, and it's that kind of jangling sound. And there's an association worldwide, you know, between the use of percussion instruments and rites of transition or altered states, people entering into altered states of consciousness, either through breathing or through the help of percussion sounds. And this is very much going on here. The song goes on and on, has a lot of repetition, and there's a lot of participation in it. It's also, there's a song almost in complete darkness. And so the darkness intensifies the sound in the space.
Did you experience an altered state of consciousness at any point through the music with the people?
Yeah, I frequently found when I was recording, and I'd be recording in the darkness and so forth, sometimes I'd listen to the recordings afterwards, and certain parts would be really very poor as recordings, and I knew that I just sort of got out of it. And I have one recording, in fact, where after 15 or 20 minutes, there's this very loud smashing sound. I realized that I had gotten so sort of out of my body with it that I was banging the microphone, tapping the microphone on my leg and with the meter of the song. And this just happens to you. You become very involved in it.
From what you're describing, it sounds like it's a society in which people walk around crying half the time. You know, that...
Well, it's not a society where people walk around crying half the time, but it's certainly a society where people try and make each other cry often.
Do you experience weeping now, or sadness now? Do you cry like a Kalali anytime?
Well, I have on occasion, but, you know, this business about the symbolism of weeping, you know, is not just related to, not just, you know, focused in Kalali society. I mean, I think we have certain kinds of things like it. And with this business of we can produce tears either from pain or from tremendous ecstatic pleasure or trance kinds of states. But also, I think it's a common expression in our culture that you hear a performance, a piece of music or something like that, and it moves you to tears. And we also talk about how instrumentalists cry on their instruments as a way of evoking an aesthetic statement about how they perform. It's often said, for instance, of alto saxophone players or soprano saxophone players who have a really high, strong, wailing kind of tone with a certain kind of vibrato. I think a lot of Ornette Coleman or Sidney Bechet, that they cry on their instrument. And indeed, the one of all the music from outside cultures which I played for the Kalali people, the one thing which they thought was most beautiful was Sidney Bechet playing soprano saxophone, because they said that the soprano saxophone was really a bird. It was the sound, it was like the sound of these fruit doves, and the fact that the tonality of the songs had these minor thirds in the traditional blues scale and so forth, and the interval of the minor third in descent, what we call the sort of blues interval, is in fact the most important interval that goes through all of their songs. They call it the waterfall. It's really the primary interval. They heard that and they just, they said, well, people in your place really must cry when they hear that, don't they? I mean, that's what their response was. They wanted to know, because that could make people cry. Along the same lines, I told people that there was a musician where I came from whose name was Bird. A friend wrote to me and said, if they're so hip to birds, why don't you tell them about Parker? So I played some recordings of Charlie Parker for them, and I said, here was this guy who, you know, he could fly on his instrument, and people called him Bird. Well, of course, that's a lie. That's not why he was nicknamed Bird. But we talked about that, and I said, there's this saying, which is Bird lives, and it means that after this person is gone, people still hear his music. At that point, they said, oh, you really must be like us. You people really must understand something.
That's great. Has your music been influenced by being exposed to this music?
Yes, I think so. I think I've become much more aware of natural sounds. I find myself listening a lot to recordings of birds. I find myself playing with them and feeling that there is the sort of ecological and aesthetic coevolution that they have in their society is really influential in my own. I find myself playing panpipes made out of hunting calls and things like that, because the sounds of the world really, why separate them from music?
Will you be going back?
I hope so. I very much want to, either for shorter periods of time or for a long stay again. You see, now that I know the language, now that I know some of the basic stuff, now that the people know me, so that the fun is beginning. I mean, I really would like to carry on a personal, as well as an aesthetic, an intellectual relationship with these people. I mean, the people who I spend a lot of time with when I'm there, they're the Kalali Cecil Taylors, the Kalali Platos. I mean, they're intellectuals. I mean, they love to sit around and listen to this music, to analyze it, to talk about it all day long. And now that I'm at a point when I can talk about can talk with a composer and say, well, how do you get this waterfall in your head? You know, what is inspiration about? And they listen to me talk about it. Well, then it really creates a different thing. And that's what makes fieldwork meaningful, not just the sort of strip mining of going in there and collecting a lot of stuff and running away with it a month later. I want to have a relationship with these people musically and intellectually.
Well, everything that you've told us would make it awfully difficult to think of the Kalalea music as being primitive.
Yes, I hope that has gotten across.
Steve, I want to thank you very much for bringing some of this music for us this afternoon. And thanks very much, and I hope you could come back sometime. We'll talk some more.
Thank you.
Been talking to Steve Feld, who lives now in Philadelphia. He's an ethnomusicologist. We've been talking about some of the music that he recorded during the year that he spent in New Guinea living with the Kalalea people, and he might be returning there at some point. He's also a jazz musician and plays lower brass instruments and is, in fact, about to go on the road for a few concert performances. I hope that goes well for you, Steve.
Thanks.